accession number 20618, reel 1.
General Richardson, reel 1, where were you born, please?
I was born in Cairo, actually, and in 1922, and my father was stationed there.
Was your father a professional army officer?
Yes, he was a regular soldier. He became a general as well.
How long did you spend in Egypt?
Oh, we were there for about, well, I came back when I was 9 months old for leave, and then we went back to Alexandria, and I suppose about 2, we came back and were stationed at Farnborough. My father was at Aldershot at that time. After that, we went out to Germany, up to Catrick, and I was at school in the north of Yorkshire.
At which school?
Well, I went to a prep school at a place called Glen Howe at Saltburn-by-the-Sea in Cleveland, and then eventually went to Wellington College and left there in 1940.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
Yes, I did, actually. My father was in Hong Kong, my parents were in Hong Kong, stationed there, but I was staying with a friend in Essex, and we did listen to it that Sunday. His father was mobilised, he was in the artillery too, and immediately was sent for.
How did you feel about the news of the war outbreak?
Well, I think we were fairly well prepared for it. Yes, it was, I don't know, I suppose dramatic, actually. In a way, it was something which, after all, we'd been taught at school that our great country had to be looked after, and I was very happy to, I was going to go into the army anyway. And so I felt that, all right, something had to be done. I quite understood that what was there. And at the time of the Munich crisis, I was staying with friends up in the Baltic, actually, in Latvia. And one realised, actually, what the problem was at that stage. I think we all thought it was just about time we did stop the Nazi Germany going further than they'd been going already.
How had you come to have friends in Latvia?
Well, this happened a long time ago. My father came from Norwich, and he had a girlfriend there who eventually married a chap who worked for Shell. And he was in charge of Shell for the whole of the Baltic states at that stage. And as my father was in Hong Kong, he thought that it might be nice if I went and stayed with him in Latvia, because I never got to Hong Kong. We weren't allowed to join our families then, they were overseas in those days.
What were conditions like in Latvia in 1938?
Oh, very nice, actually. They were very xenophobic, actually. They're proud of being Latvian. We did go around the country at one stage. Riga was a lovely town. It was in the summer, but he had a nice house on the coast, actually, about 9 miles outside Riga, with a lovely beach, and I don't know, it was a very civilised place.
So they were suspicious of foreigners?
No. They were, in fact, actually very friendly. They spoke what I always called Lettish, and they sometimes call it Latvian these days, and German and Russian. But they were a bit suspicious of Germans, not much. It's a fairly large Jewish community there, too.
What was their attitude towards you as an Englishman?
Well, I was only 16 at the time, actually, and they were perfectly friendly as to what we were doing, actually. You know, in fact, the British Army, a lot of our friends out there were people who were learning Russian, because if they were learning Russian in those days, they were stationed in Riga. They were sent to Riga to learn Russian.
Did you come across any attitude towards Soviet Russia?
No, not really. They were, in fact, actually, they were glad to be free of Russia, and in fact, they changed some of the names of the towns. Dvinsk, which was on the Dvina, was in fact changed to Daugavpils, and the name of the river was called the Daugava, because that was the original Latvian name. They wore Latvian clothes, you know, that sort of theirs. Anyway, they were pleased to be alone. They had no fear basically of the Russians at that stage. They just enjoyed their independence.
Coming back to the war, were you in any bombing of England by the German Air Force?
Oh, yes. At the end of 1940, I was at school and at Wellington, and I was a senior college prefect and head of ARP in Christmas term 1940, when college was bombed and the headmaster was killed, actually, standing in front of the lodge. A nice young man. And I had to rush around with the trailer pump, trying to put the fire out before the fire engine came, and then go and look for him. But we found later on that he was under the porch in the front of the lodge. And then when I left, we was in a special squad, actually, having taken higher certificate, which we were all public school boys, basically. But we had to go and do recruits training first and then go to a university for 6 months instead of going to Woolwich. But before that, therefore in December and January, because I didn't have to get to the recruits training until February, I was fire watching in London, actually, on the Fitzroy Square on the top of a building there. They paid me the principal sum of £4 a week, actually, for doing that, which was pretty good, with a friend. And so I stayed in London, and they were bombing London at that stage. We had a sort of metal box on the top of the roof, because what was mostly coming down was the splinters from the anti-aircraft shells in Regent's, which were being shot up from Regent's Park. But no, we didn't get any incendiaries landing on our roof, so we were all right.
Is Fitzroy Square Bloomsbury?
It's basically speaking not far from King's Cross, that sort of way. Yes, I'm trying to remember exactly where it is, actually. Yes, it's Bloomsbury, basically. It's not far from Regent's Park.
Did any bombs fall near you in the London bombing?
Well, only that a few incendiaries fell around, actually, in the streets, and but nothing actually which broke our windows at that stage.
How did public morale stand up to the bombing?
Yeah, well, everyone was perfectly accepted it. I mean, you had ARP was well organised, people went to shelters, everybody took it as it happened, actually, and we everything carried on. You didn't stop anything, you just kept going, and we didn't stop the trains. It was, unless there was serious damage, but no, everything kept going. We kept on. Before that, actually, at the beginning of the war, when I was in Essex at the beginning of the war, of course, we did have to handle the evacuation of children from London, and we had to meet them and disperse them to houses at that stage. That was at the beginning of the war.
Have you any specific memories of that?
Well, only that the ladies organised things so well. We met them all off the train. They all had labels on them. We fed them and then managed to distribute them to families where they were looked after. I think eventually quite a lot of them went home again, but not to begin with.
Whereabouts in Essex was that?
That was at Wakes Cone, actually. That was Earl's Cone, that sort of area. Not far from Colchester, really. But the train used to come out there. We picked them up. I've forgotten exactly where it was, Harlow or something like that, actually, and then they were dispersed.
Had you thought in this early part of the war that the Germans might win the war?
No, never. Well, after all, I mean, we had the whole of the British Empire, actually, on which was a formidable time. Admittedly, after Dunkirk, and I can remember Dunkirk and the organisation, I was at school then. In the summer, we stopped back at school and used to sit at the top of the tower at Wellington College to see whether any parachutists were landing or anything like that. I mean, we were ready to, members of the local defence force, LDV, we were. And I don't know, we all felt that we could cope, whatever. Of course, that summer, my father got back from Hong Kong the first Christmas of the war. And he was organising, he was Brigadier then, organising a mobilisation control centre in the Cotswolds. And so we used to see whether we were in London with the aircraft overhead and that sort of thing. And one believed that the Air Force were going to manage. But it was a phony war at that stage. Before that had happened, and then when Dunkirk happened, I suppose we were mobilising ourselves, but we were convinced that the Germans would never manage to defeat us in this country.
What kind of experiences did you have in LDB?
Nothing very much, actually, only just sort of walking around and patrolling, that was all. But as I say, we used to do parachute watching in the summer to see what was going on. But that was in the early part of the war. And what was one was 18. Because I know I did apply to my father and said, well, perhaps I could join the Air Force because you can join the Air Force at 17 and a half. And he said, well, it's much tougher in the army. You have to work 7 days a week, 24 hours a day when you're fighting, actually. And so he persuaded me that I stopped on for another term at school and joined the army.
Which unit of LDV were you in?
Oh, that was just the school, local defence volunteers.
How had you come to head the ARP at Wellington?
Well, I happened to be a senior college prefect, and we all had tasks to do as to whether, and we called ourselves, there were about three of us were members of the Upper Ten, and that was meant to be a responsible post, and so that was a senior boy as far as air raid precautions were concerned.
What did it involve?
Well, it meant sleeping actually under the science laboratory where we had the sort of headquarters of the LDV with somebody on duty and were ready to turn out in an emergency if anything happened. We actually only got bombed twice, once when the headmaster was killed and the other time they dropped some bombs, very dark night. And I went out there with a French master who was on duty at that time. And we eventually found out where the bombs had fallen and they hadn't done any damage whatsoever, except knock some holes in the playing ground.
In this early part of the war, would you listen much to wireless?
I suppose one did listen to the news, yes. And of course, one was following what was going on. In fact, actually, once I had been called up, actually, in 1941, you wondered whether, in fact, the war might be over before you actually managed to get in to the army itself, actually, having gone to recruits training and done my 6 months at Edinburgh University doing maths and science, and then going to OCTU at Alton Towers, near Uttoxeter. I didn't get commissioned until March 1942. And obviously one was following what was going on. But that stage, of course, Russia was involved in the war. That was a dramatic time because one wasn't quite sure actually whether we were going to fight the communists or whether and Churchill took the decision that we were friends with the communists and we had to defeat the Germans. And that was it.
How did you feel about that?
Quite agreed what he was doing. Churchill's speeches were very dramatic and were absolutely fantastic. And we were all totally determined that we would all do our bit, whatever happened.
Did you ever listen to Haw Haw?
No, I don't think so. One read in the newspapers what he'd said and who he was and that sort of thing, so you knew. But bear in mind that of the people who were at school with me in my house at Wellington at the end of the war, we all did our bit, and one third of them were killed.
Any incidents or things that we should record about your period of training in that period of 41-42?
No, I don't think so. It was... Recruits training at Borden was, you actually met for the first time, I suppose. Well, no, I had met them before, for I had been down to Bertha Tidwell in South Wales and stayed with miners and things like that. So, but you did meet the cross-section of the of people who, the rough and the ready, and you realise what nice people they were, but however they were different from you. And but it was good to know and have friends with them and meet them, and then be segregated again to go to Edinburgh University, where in fact we were a special squad and were probably the linchpin for the defence of Edinburgh if the Germans had arrived in the Firth of Forth, because we had a we weren't actually paid while we were at Edinburgh, although they paid all expenses, and we had to form up and carry on Bren guns and things and go to some slag heap outside Egbert, the other side of Leith, actually, to be the first line of defence if anybody had come that way. And we were very pleased to do that. We did one or two exercises and defeated the people coming who were testing our defence. And we have stopped them up completely. But we had to go and let them through to test some people who were behind us. But otherwise, one had a nice time out there, playing golf, tennis, even shooting grouse and that sort of thing. No, it was we were there from April until September, when we went down to Bulford, where we had about a month before we went to Octu. And there we did some splendid, almost artillery exercises. Now, the one thing we did at Octu, actually, which was probably extraordinary, was we had just been sent some guns from America. They were 75mm guns used in the First War, and we took them out on a drill order for the first time. And I can remember number 4 gun actually did discover in the limber actually a round which they thought was a drill purposes only round. It had a ring in its nose, and when ordered to fire a round of gunfire, they stuck it in the breech actually and pulled the trigger, and it went off bang. It was, in fact, aimed at the officer's mess, and luckily we had made a number of errors, and it wasn't. It was, it went into a wood, but it didn't go off bang at the other end because it hadn't got a fuse in it, but we spent the afternoon looking for it. We did polish up the brass cartridge case and engrave it and give it to our squad officer, who was a chap called Roberts. He was known as One Round Roberts from then on. That was in Alton Towers in the woods.
Right.
That was up in Alton Towers, and they used to go beagling and be fit. I used to box for them too in those days.
Did you have any wishes or ambitions regarding the army at this stage?
No, I was quite happy to do what anybody told me to do. Funnily enough, at the end of the time when we were posted, I knew I was going to be posted to a senior regiment, if it was a horse artillery regiment probably, because we were all field artillery. But someone came down actually from the SEO, Arthur Fair, who was a commanding officer, who was a regular. And he asked if anybody came from Essex, which nobody did. And so, did anybody come from East Anglia? And I put up my hand and said, yes, my family came from Norfolk, which was why I went into the Essex Yeomanry. The Essex Yeomanry at that stage had been that particular 147, which was their second line. The first line was out in the desert. Had been drafted to the 42nd Armoured Division, which was in Yorkshire at that time. And the 42nd Armoured Division was the ex-Lancashire Division. And the Essex Yeomanry were the artillery regiment supporting the Armoured Brigade of that particular Armoured Division, who became, in due course, the Funnies and Normandy.
What happened to you next?
What happened to me next? I got posted to join the Essex Yeomanry up in Yorkshire. I joined them at Thirsk Racecourse. And I was an assistant troop leader in Charlie Troop of 431 Battery. And we had towed 25-pounders. And we had General Dempsey as our divisional commander. And we did a number of splendid exercises across the moors and across Yorkshire at that time. Basically, we were capturing a river crossing, securing that, and then sending the Armoured Brigade hurtling on during the night to do a major advance. That was what he was teaching us to do. And then we'd have a conference in Scarborough afterwards. Oh no, it was there, and I learnt a lot. I learnt my job very well, and eventually finished up as a gun position officer of dog troop in the end. But that was, I was a troop leader of Charlie Troop during Exercise Spartan, where we started in Yorkshire, and we finished up in Frome in Somerset.
And what exactly was Spartan?
Exercise Spartan was an exercise for the whole army in 1943. March was meant to be bad weather. Actually, the weather was simply marvellous all the way through, apart from being cold at night. The sun shone, and I think basically they had won. The army at that stage was in the UK, was deployed. I think the Canadians were there on one side, and we were on the other side anyway, and we got down towards, Cotswolds, and then we drew and we finished up country. And it was a major exercise in March, in order to see that we were, organised. But of course, we weren't going to do the invasion that year. In fact, I can't remember whether it was before North Africa or it must have been about the time. I can't remember North Africa was now. But anyway. We weren't involved in that. I can remember that summer was the Dieppe raid, I think that's right, yes. And after we'd got down south, we were doing a number of special exercises on Salisbury Plain to see how good we were as a sort of horse artillery regiment supporting armour. We then were given self-propelled guns. We got priests, actually, that autumn, and we were sent up to Les Mahego, Glasgow, and we did our first exercises on landing craft up at Rothsay. And we used to, at that time, we were planning, I think, to do the invasion in the dark. They were going to land at dawn, so we had to do the running shoot, which we all knew what we were going to have to do in the dark. And we used to, my God, what was it, Kilmarnock Island or something. Anyway, it was, we used to go through the Kyles of Bute and run down the outside in the dark. It was all a bit difficult. They had a light, actually, luckily, where we were firing at. But we used to do live firing. From there, we went up to do some more exercises up at Muir of Ord, near Inverness. That was in the middle of the night. And I remember the landing craft used to sort of bump into one another in the rough weather, and it was all a bit rough. So it, I think, decided at that stage that the invasion would be a little bit after dawn, and that we would put in the fire support, in daylight. So we then went down to Brandon in Suffolk Norfolk border. Where we, in fact, handed in our priests, which were the American guns, and we got brand new Sextons, 25-pounders, which had been made in Canada, and we got them off the boat very nearly down at the Thames, and they were absolutely brand spanking new, which was marvellous. We were given every piece of equipment we could want. We had to actually teach. What was it? Well, it must have been 2nd RHA and 5th RHA, who were in the 11th Armoured Division, how to use their guns, because they just got them and never had them before. And then we went down to Bournemouth, where we started waterproofing the guns, actually. We were in the Carlton Hotel in Bournemouth. And then they locked us up in the New Forest, and we finished the waterproofing. And we were doing some run-and-shoot practices on Studland Bay and finished up by doing our dress rehearsal. On the beach towards Portsmouth Way. Anyway, Hayling Island. And the Navy didn't even know that it was a dress rehearsal, because when we eventually loaded where were we, near Bewley, on the landing craft, and we were moved. We moved to Southampton, where they, when we were all tied up near the where the transatlantic liners used to tie up, and the Navy still thought it was another rehearsal we were going on. I, in fact, was the only one who knew where we were going and what we were going to do.
You knew it was going to be Normandy?
Yes. I knew, by that stage I'd been briefed, actually, but nobody else had been. The Navy had sealed orders on the landing craft. And we set off, of course, to do the invasion on the 5th.
What rank did you have at this time?
I was a lieutenant. I had the gun position officer of D Troop, which was four guns, and I had my troop leader, who was another lieutenant, on the boat. That was the only, just the two of us. With four guns, two tanks, two half-tracks, and three carriers, I think probably that's about it. Yeah. On the landing craft. And we set off on the 4th, I suppose it was, yes, because... yes, right, because but we got as far as Yarmouth, Isle of Wight. There we were tied up for the night to a large buoy. I think it was still there. And I, in fact, had the job of briefing the chaps. There were about 60 of us on the landing craft as to what they were going to do. In fact, the only time they ever listened to every word I said, they were wonderful. And read out various things from Eisenhower and Monty and Dempsey. And our job, in fact, was to support 231 Brigade and the assault with 50 Dib on the right of the British line at a place called Le Hamel, which is known as Nell, but near Arromanches. And so the next day, actually, we set off and sailed past the Needles in the evening. With the sunshine out, squadrons of Spitfires flying overhead, destroyers going down. We were in sort of a column of two of us, you know, a long column, so far as you could see. And the destroyers were flashing lamps at us saying, "The wind will abate." So, anyway, full of confidence, off we went. And through the night, and arrived at dawn the next morning, ready to do our run-in-shoot, which was, of course, obviously to fire the preliminary bombardment, actually, before anybody landed. The only thing was, there should have been six of us trooping each. There was actually only five of us. We'd lost one landing craft during the night. But more important, we'd lost our ML, the motor launch, which had the radar on, called Mickey Mouse, which was to tell us what range we were to open at and what bearing to open at, exactly where we were. I was the sort of left front. There were three and then two. But across on the left was 90th Field, actually, and they'd got their ML. We got in touch with them by lamp. And I said, "Please give us our opening range and fix." And so they gave us the opening range and fix, and so off we went. Because one of our battery commanders was forward, actually, observing where we were landing and gave us corrections. But in fact, of course, the guns were lined up with the landing craft, and you were on the bridge, actually, seeing the landing craft was going in the right direction. As we closed in, of course, you shortened the range. And I forgot we fired about 200 rounds a gun, actually, in that running shoot. We closed to about 2,000 yards by HR. Then we swung off to go round and beach. By that time, the tanks were meant to be in. They couldn't swim in because it was a bit too rough for them, so they, in fact, actually were taken in a bit closer, and they did get ashore. And it was on our sector, it was the 13th, 18th Hussars. Round we went, and I had a very nice chap in charge of the landing craft, who was a young London policeman, actually, very good. I said to him, "We'll go in half a head together, and don't you dare slow up, because I'm going to get my stuff ashore properly." So anyway, we ploughed in, and there were actually people in the water, and there were these obstacles and things. Anyway.